Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Joanne Harris, who reads from and discusses her new book, Rune Marks, published by Random House. In the weeks to come, we have Madeline Albright, Stephen Cannell, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore. And thank you for silencing your cell phones. Joanne Harris's name is synonymous with good literature and unforgettable characters. Upon hearing her name, so many titles come to mind. Chocolat, Five Quarters of the Orange, Blackberry Wine, and so many others. She has also written a lovely cookbook memoir, My French Kitchen. Today, she will be presenting her first young adult book, Rune Marks. And we have some very exciting news. In April, William Morrow will publish the long-awaited sequel to Chocolat, The Girl with No Shadow. Please pick up a bookmark when you have your book signed. Now, please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Joanne Harris.
Hello there. It's very nice to be here. Very nice to be here talking about this book, which I had a great time writing, and which is not necessarily quite as different as you might expect to some of my other books. I know it's being sold to you as a young adult, but this shouldn't put off the adults, because in my view, imagination is not something that you should grow out of. In fact, quite the opposite. I think the children of our young adult type people should be teaching their parents how to remember what it was like to be like that and to believe in the fantastic and the wonderful. And I started this book really as a kind of game. I write a lot of stuff which is not for publication, which is either for personal fun or as an exercise in creating something that I don't usually do, or sometimes just to entertain somebody else. And in the case of this book, it was a bedtime story for my daughter that grew slightly out of hand. At the time, I was writing something else, something quite difficult, something quite dark, and I needed some kind of stepping stone, just something to go to occasionally when I didn't want to be in that dark, emotionally demanding place. And so I started writing this story, which was very much based on the things that I had liked as a child and that I continue to like. Folklore, mythology, and particularly the myths of the Norse countries, which are basically all around our stamping ground in Yorkshire, the Scandinavians, the Icelanders, the Germans, the Danes. And because I live in Yorkshire, and because Yorkshire was really where all those people decided that they wanted to be rather than Iceland, Denmark, and Sweden, they ended up there, and a lot of their culture accompanied them, and a lot of their stories and a lot of their leavings accompanied them. And so I was brought up with a certain kind of folk tale as a child. And I liked them a lot more than I liked the Romans and the Greeks, who, though interesting, I don't know, they just struck me as being a bit stuffy. You know, all these people high up on Olympus doing good for the human race. And though all that was very fine, much, much finer were these tales of the Norsemen with these kind of hairy old warlords trogging the hell out of each other with hammers and axes, and basically not caring a bit about mankind or what might happen on the earth, but just really having adventures and doing things for their own little selves. And one of the great things about these myths that I liked was that the characters involved just seemed to be so human. You know, we expect our gods to be lofty. Viking gods are not lofty. Viking gods have got exactly the same faults that human beings have, and sometimes rather more of them. They can be wrong, they can be flawed, they can be quite spectacularly stupid, they can be mischievous, some of them can be downright evil, they can be selfish, and they can also be rude and very, very funny, which was one of the things that attracted me first to this pantheon, the fact that gods could be funny, could play rude tricks on each other, could could say things that you as a child only wished that you could say from time to time. And there was a recognizable pantheon of characters. The Vikings worshipped mostly gods, but also goddesses. The goddesses were less prominent, which means that I've given them a little more prominence in this story, but the gods were basically Odin, who was the king of the gods, who was the great warlord who had birthed a number of gods and who kept most of the runes and the magic for himself, which meant that he could never be overthrown. And he wasn't particularly loved, although he was venerated by the Vikings. They didn't like him all that much because he was a bit scary, a bit unpredictable. And you weren't ever quite sure whether what he was doing was for his own purpose or for you. Then there was Thor, who was by far the most popular god. And he was big and strong and hairy and not very bright. And one of the reasons they liked him was that he was not very bright. A bit like some presidents we could name, really, whose popularity perhaps came by being a man of the people, as opposed to somebody that you could really look up to. There was Frey, who was the god of the harvest, but also had something to do with death, who used to ride around on a golden pig with bristles and whiskers of gold, and who had a ship that used to be able to fold up to the size of a pocket handkerchief in his pocket. There was Njord, the god of the sea. There was Tyr, the god of war. And then there was Loki, who was always my favourite in the stories, partly because, well, he was the instigator of all this mischief and this fun that to me made these stories better than other kinds of mythology. And he wasn't really a god at all. He was one of those people. You know, sometimes you go to a party and someone is there causing trouble and nobody dares comment about it because they're sure that somebody important invited him and nobody did. Well, Loki's a bit like this. And one of the reasons he's so important in the Norse myths is that he is the one who stirs the pot. He's the one who starts things off. And there wouldn't be any stories if there wasn't Loki, because he is always trying to find out how much he can push people, what sort of a rise he can get out of people. And sometimes he does nasty, vindictive, mischievous things just to see if he can get away with it. And sometimes he does. In fact, nearly always he does. And the fact that these characters were so recognisable and the fact that there were so few myths that had really survived, because these are people who had to carve their stories in stone and they had better things to do than to write all their stories down, and so most of them were written down hundreds of years after everybody had stopped believing in Viking gods at all. So there weren't very many stories, which is frustrating on the one side, but also quite good if you were a kid like me who liked writing stories and who would take a character and make up more stories about them. Nowadays, they call it fan fiction. In those days, they called it being over-imaginative, and it was a bad thing. Well, in time, I got a daughter who reached the age of 9 and who was told in no uncertain terms by her teachers that she too was over-imaginative and should put a stop to it. And I started writing this story for her, chapter by chapter. And it was about Norse gods and the end of the world. And she liked it so much that she made me write some more. And eventually, it became 500 pages of book, and here it is. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the world of this book, because it's important to understand that most people's stories are made by their environment and by the people who surround them. The world and the time. Now, the world is a very small world. It's an island, a little island in the middle of a big sea, and like another little island that I happen to live on, it still considers itself to be the centre of the civilised world. Everything else is outlands, and nobody goes there. And this world is a world in transition. There has been a big battle, a cataclysmic event, 500 years before. Now, the Norse people called this Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods, and they believed that the world would actually come to an end. The gods would all be killed, and that would be it. I told you these people had bleak and difficult lives, and their stories were bleak and difficult, and the idea of happy ever after just never occurred to them. But of course, we know that the world didn't come to an end. We also know that the Norse culture did, and that something must have replaced it. So obviously the world of the Vikings came to an end, not through any kind of cataclysmic battle between gods and demons, as was predicted in their stories, but by something a little simpler than that. And to me, very clearly, when I was a kid, I thought, well, That was obviously the Romans. The Romans came and they brought a different culture, and more importantly, they brought Christianity. And Christianity is one of those beliefs that is very tenacious, very forceful. It gets everywhere, and it subverts and replaces what it finds. And the early Christians replaced the Celtic beliefs, replaced the Norse beliefs by beliefs of their own. And that really was what wiped out the old gods. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if you could write a story about that, set in a fantasy world where the old gods haven't actually been wiped out, they've just been defeated, and they're still there, wandering the earth, and a new order has arrived, something which is not Christianity, but which is in some ways a little bit similar. A crusading, well-organized, militant, patriarchal religion determined to wipe out everything else. And in this book, in Rune Marks, that religion is called the Order. And it is quite sinister in some ways. First of all men, all very young men, who are taken away from their families. They're told to cut all ties with their families, to get rid of their names, and they are given a number. And that makes them part of the Order. And as they go up the levels of learning of the Order, eventually they are given power and influence. They're given access to books, which are banned to ordinary people. They're given access to knowledge of history, which also is restricted to ordinary people. And more importantly, they are given access to what they call the Word, which is a kind of magic, but a kind of magic which the Order is allowed to use because it believes itself to be divine, whereas ordinary magic comes from chaos and is therefore demonic in origin and needs to be wiped out. And 500 years after the end of the world, the Order is beginning to wipe out everything that it believes to do with magic or chaos or the old gods or fairies or demons or even superstitions, and even dreams and stories are being cut back and curtailed, because who knows what happens when you dream? You might get ideas. If you get ideas, who knows what you might do? You might imagine something about the Order was maybe not quite as true as they made out that it was. And into this world comes a girl called Maddie, who is kind of a little bit like I was at 14, very like my daughter is now at 14. And she is, let's say, she is the awkward squad. She is troublesome. She is stubborn. She's clever. Which is the most terrible thing in this world for a girl, because girls don't need to be clever. Girls need to be pretty. And then they need to get married. And then they need to shut up. And Maddie doesn't do any of these things. Maddie has a very pretty, very nice sister who thinks that Maddie is utterly deplorable. But Maddie has ideas well beyond her station. And worse still, she has been born with this mark on her hand. This thing that the villagers call a ruin mark, and obviously anything which is ruined is second rate, is damaged, is bad. And to these people, this mark signifies that she has bad blood, blood that belongs to an earlier age, blood that carries with it a taint of magic and of what might be demonic. And partly because of this, and partly because her personality is awkward and difficult, Maddie is not liked. Now, Maddie can't read, hasn't been allowed to read. Nobody in her village has been allowed to read except the parson and his little apprentices, who hopefully one day will grow up to be examiners of the Order. So Maddie doesn't know that this thing on her hand is not a blemish at all, but in fact a rune. And rune magic was one of those things that went through the whole of the European and Scandinavian culture for hundreds of years. Every country had its own slightly different runic system, but they were all more or less the same. They were these spiky little letters, and they were spiky because you could carve them on sticks and stones, and obviously that looping Roman alphabet was almost impossible to use. And each rune had a sound. You could just look at it as the letter of an alphabet. But they also had other significances as well. Each rune was a magical symbol. Each one had its own name. In the early English system of runes, each one had its own little verse poem which explained what it was and what it did. And you could use them in all sorts of different ways. You could carve one on your sword to make it more powerful. You could carry it on a charm or an amulet or a piece of jewelry for luck, for wealth. You could use it to thwart your enemies. You could speak runes, a bit like you might speak a magic spell, and there were secret runes that only Odin, the chief of the gods, had, and his power was in the fact that nobody else knew these runes. There were runes to make you attractive to the opposite sex, runes to bring you wealth and cattle. You could fling runes at people. Not physically fling them, but fling them with your mind. There were mind weapon runes that you could use in battle to psych out your enemies. And people feared these runes, and people who could use them were considered very powerful and were respected. And this is what Maddie has on her hand. But she doesn't know what it is, and neither does anybody else. Except a friend of hers, who calls himself One Eye, and who is not quite what he appears. And I'm going to read to you something from the beginning of the book. Not quite the beginning of the book, but just something that introduces this world and its thinking and what is believed, because what we're going to get eventually is a battle between an old order and a new order, with possibly the future of the world and maybe all possible worlds at stake. And this is where it starts, in a little place, a little village called Morbury, a little bit like the village I live in, where even to be from the other side of the hill is to be a dangerous outsider. Morbury was a village of some 800 souls, a quiet place, or so it seemed, set between mountain ridges in the valley of the River Strond, which flowed from the Wilderlands in the north through the uplands and the inlands, before finally making its way south towards World's End and into the One Sea. The mountains, called the Seven Sleepers, though no one remembered exactly why, were bitter and snow-cloaked all year round, and there was only one pass, the Hinderfell, which was blocked by snow 3 months of the year. This remoteness affected the valley folk. They kept to themselves. They were suspicious of strangers, and, but for Nat Parson, who had once made a pilgrimage as far as World's End, and who considered himself quite the traveller, had little to do with the world outside. There were a dozen little settlements in the valley, from Farnley Tyus at the foot of the mountains to Peace Green at the far side of Little Bear Wood. But Morbury was the biggest and the most important. It housed the valley's only parson, the largest church, the best inns, the wealthiest farmers. Its houses were built of stone, not wood. There was a smithy, a glassworks, a covered market. Its inhabitants thought themselves better than most, and looked down on the folk of Pog Hill or Fettlefields and laughed in secret at their country ways. The only thorn in Morbury's side stood roughly 2 miles from the village. The locals called it Red Horse Hill, and most folk avoided it, because of the tales that collected there and the goblins who lived beneath its flanks. Once it was said there'd been a castle on the hill. Morbury itself had been part of its fiefdom, growing crops for the lord of that land. But all that had been a long time ago, before tribulation and the end of the world. Nowadays there was nothing to see, only a few standing stones, too large to have been looted from the ruins, and of course the red horse, cut into the clay. It had long been known as a goblin stronghold. Such places drew them, the villagers said, lured them with promises of treasure and tales of the Elder Age, but it was only in recent years that the good folk had ventured as far as the village. 14 years, to be precise, which was exactly when Jed Smith's pretty wife, Julia, had died, giving birth to their second daughter. Few doubted that the two things were linked, or that the rust-coloured mark on the palm of the child's hand was the sign of some dreadful misfortune to come. And so it was. From that day forth, that harvest month, the goblins had been drawn to the blacksmith's child. The midwife had seen them, so she said, perched on the baby's pinewood crib, or grinning from inside the warming pan, or tumbling the blankets. At first the rumours were scarcely voiced. Nan Fay was mad, just like her old grandam, and it was best to take anything she said with a dose of salt. But as time passed and goblin sightings were reported by such respectable sources as the parson, his wife, Ethelberta, and even Torval Bishop from over the pass, the rumours grew, and soon everyone was wondering how the Smiths of all people, the Smiths, who never dreamed, went to church every day and would no more have flung themselves into the River Strond than truckle with the good folk, could have given birth to two so very different daughters. May Smith, with her cowslip curls, was widely held to be the prettiest and the least imaginative girl in the village. Jed Smith said she was the image of her poor mother, and it almost broke his heart to see her so, though he smiled when he said it, and his eyes were like stars. But Maddie was dark, just like an outlander, and there was no light in Jed's eyes when he looked at her, only an odd kind of measuring look, as if he were weighing Maddie against her dead mother and finding that he'd been sold short. Jed Smith was not the only one to think so. As she grew older, Maddie discovered that she had disappointed almost everyone. An awkward girl, with a sullen mouth, a curtain of hair, and a tendency to slouch, she had neither May's sweet nature nor her sweet face. Her eyes were rather beautiful, halfway between grey and gold, but few people ever noticed this, and it was widely held that Maddie Smith was ugly, a troublemaker, too clever for her own good, too stubborn or too slack to change. Of course, folk agreed that it was not her fault she was so brown, or her sister so pretty, but a smile costs nothing, as the saying goes, and if only the girl had made an effort once in a while, or even showed a little gratitude for all the help and free advice she'd been given, then maybe she would have settled down. But she did not. From the beginning, Maddie was wild, never laughed, never cried, never brushed her hair, fought with Adam Scattergood and broke his nose, and if that wasn't already bad enough, showed signs of being clever. Disastrous in a girl, with a tongue on her that could be downright rude. No one mentioned the ruin mark, of course. In fact, for the first 7 years of her life, no one had even explained to Maddie what it meant, though May pulled faces and called it your blemish, and was surprised when Maddie refused to wear the mittens sent to her by the villagers' charitable and ever-hopeful widows. Someone needed to put things straight with the girl, and at last Nat Parson accepted the unpleasant duty of telling her the facts. Maddie didn't understand much of it, littered as it was with quotes from the good book, but she understood his contempt, and behind it his fear. It was all written down in the Book of Tribulation, how after the battle the old gods, the seer folk of that time, had been cast into Netherworld, but how in dreams they still endured, fragmented but still dangerous, entering the minds of the wicked and the susceptible, trying desperately to be reborn. And so their demon blood lives on, had said the parson, passed from man to woman, beast to beast, and here you are, by no fault of your own, and as long as you say your prayers and remember your place, there's no reason why you shouldn't leave as worthwhile a life as any of the rest of us and earn forgiveness at the hand of the nameless. Now Maddie had never liked Nat Parson. She watched him in silence as he spoke, occasionally lifting her left hand and peering at him insolently through the circle of her thumb and forefinger. Nat itched to slap her, but Laws knew what powers her demon blood had given her, and he wanted as little to do with the girl as possible. The Order would have known what to do with the child. But this was Morbury, not World's End. And even such a stickler as Nat knew better than to try to enforce World's End law so far from the Universal City. "Do you understand?" he spoke, loudly and slowly. Perhaps she was simple, like crazy Nan Fay. In any case, she didn't reply, but watched him again through her crooked fingers, until at last he sighed and went away. After that, or so it seemed, Jed Smith's youngest daughter had grown wilder than ever. She stopped going to church, lived out in Little Bear Wood for days on end, and spent hours at a time talking to herself, or more likely to the goblins. And when the other children played jumpstone around the pond, or went to Nat Parson's Sunday school, Maddie ran off to Red Horse Hill, or pestered Crazy Nan for tales, or worse still, made up tales about terrible, impossible things which she told the younger ones to give them nightmares. She was an embarrassment to May, who was merry as a blue jay and as brainless, and who would have made a brilliant marriage but for her unruly sister. As compensation, May was spoilt and indulged far more than was good for her, while Maddie grew up sullen, unregarded, and angry. Well, I've always thought that it was the sullen and the unregarded and the angry teenagers who were the most interesting and the most fun. Possibly because I have one of my own. Possibly because I was one. But it is always the awkward ones that begin the stories. There is never a story that starts, a person just exactly like everybody else lived in a village and did absolutely nothing till the day they died. All my stories, whether they are for adults or for young adults or for both, tend to be beginning in the same way. There is usually a heroine, although there are plenty of heroes in this story too. They are usually an outsider. They are usually considered peculiar in some way. Very often people are afraid of outsiders. They're afraid of people who are different. And so those people fight back, and they fight back in any way they can, and they become defiant, and sometimes they make a difference. And stories are all about making differences. And this little girl, Maddie, is about to make a very big difference, because what she doesn't know, because she's only a little girl and she hasn't been told an awful lot about the real world, is that something is brewing outside of her sleepy little village and her valley. Something big. Now, the Vikings believed that the world existed between two poles. The universe was brought together by a meeting of fire and ice. And fire was chaos and ice was order. And obviously, life can't exist in either. If you have too much of an extreme one way or the other, then what you have is either fire and destruction or a cold place where nothing can possibly live. And the Vikings believed that as long as a balance was kept between order and chaos, then the worlds would be all right, and there might be fights, there might be battles, there might be upheavals. You know, there might even be something as big and cataclysmic as Ragnarok. But eventually the world would survive, the world would rebuild itself. Now, the order, this new order, this new religion, doesn't believe this at all. It believes that its mission in life is to eliminate chaos completely and to bring perfect order. And if it has to wipe out lots of people to do it, then so be it. And it is getting very strong. It's had 500 years to get very strong. And it controls history. It controls knowledge. And it has the power of the word. This mysterious kind of magic which, when uttered by every single member of the order, can just raise an entire battlefield. Thousands could just drop at one word. So it's a very powerful organization, and it is on the march towards Morbury, because what Maddie doesn't know is that the old gods, Odin and Loki and Thor and Tyr, have not quite been as wiped out as legend has said. They are still around. They are regrouping. They are quite weak. Weaker than she is, in fact, in some ways, because she is not a broken remnant of an early order, but she is something completely new. And she is actually, well, I shan't tell you exactly what she is, but I'll read you another little passage from the bit of the book where she begins to understand who she is and what her mission is. And she has been sent down into world below, underneath Red Horse Hill, where the goblins hang out, and where nobody else goes, because heaven knows there might be something good going on there. She's been sent to get an object, a magical object called the Whisperer. This turns out not to be so much an object as a kind of person, or rather the head of a person. The head, in fact, of a very, very old god. It is old, it is bad-tempered, it doesn't want to help Maddie. But it is also an oracle, and it sees the future, and when it's asked things, it has to answer, even if it doesn't want to. And Maddie has found it under the hill. And she has become trapped there with this nasty creature, this whisperer, this stone head. And it is trying to make her do something. It is trying to make her wake the old gods who have been sleeping under the hill for a very long time. And she has been guided to a cave under the hill by a goblin who turned out not to be as unfriendly as she thought, a goblin called Sugar, which isn't his personality at all, just his name. I'm going to read you a little bit from there. Not kings, but historians rule the world. It was a proverb that one I had often quoted, but even Maddie didn't quite realize how true it was. The Order of Examiners had begun 500 years ago in the Department of Records in the great University of World's End. It had to have happened there, of course. World's End was always the center of things. It was the financial capital and the home of the king. The Parliament was there and the great Cathedral of St. Sepulchre, and rumor had it that in the vaults of the Department of Records there was a library of more than 10,000 books, poetry and science and histories and grimoires, to which only the serious scholars, professors, magisters and other senior staff of the order had access. In those days, the examiners were simply officials of the university. They were entirely secular, and their examination procedures consisted merely of written tests. But after tribulation and the dark time that followed, the university had remained a symbol of order. Gradually, its influence had grown. Histories were written, conclusions drawn, dangerous books hidden away. And quietly, studiously, power had passed, not to kings or warriors, but to the Department of Records and the little clique of historians, academics, and theologians who had appointed themselves the sole chroniclers of tribulation. The Good Book had been the culmination of their work, the story of the world and of its near destruction by the forces of chaos, a catalogue of world knowledge, science, wisdom, and medicine, and a list of commandments to ensure that in the future, whatever else happened, order would always triumph. Everyone had heard tales of how some prentice had denounced his father to the order for failing to attend prayers, or how some old woman had been cleansed for decking a wishing well or keeping a cat. World's End, of course, was used to it. But if anyone had suggested to Maddie Smith that a villager of Morbury, even one as vain and stupid as Nat Parson, would deliberately court the attention of the examiners, she would never have believed them. 2 hours later, and at last the passageway had broadened out, a faint gleam reflecting dully against mica-spackled walls. The sour, cellar smell that suffused the hill no longer troubled Maddie at all. In fact, now that she thought about it, the air seemed sweeter than before, although it was growing perceptibly colder. "We're getting close to the sleepers," she said. "Aye, miss," said Sugar, who had been getting more and more nervous as they approached their goal. "Not long now. Well, that's my job done then, and if I could just be on my way." But Maddie's eye had lit upon something. A point of luminescence too pale to be firelight, too bright to be a reflection on the stone. "That's daylight," she said, her face brightening. Sugar considered putting her straight, and then he shrugged and thought better of it. "That's the sleepers, miss," he said in a low voice, and that was when his courage, already tried to breaking point, finally gave way. He could withstand many things, but enough was enough, and there comes a time for every goblin to take the better part of valour and run. Sugar and Sack turned and ran. Maddie ran towards the light, too excited to think either about Sugar's desertion or about the fact that it didn't really look like daylight at all. It was a cool and silvery light, like the pale edge of a summer pre-dawn. It was faint and penetrating. Maddie could see that it touched the sides of the passage with a milky gleam, picking out the fragments of mica in the rock and lighting the plumes of steam that came from Maddie's mouth in the cold air. It was a cavern. She could see that now. The passage broadened, became funnel-shaped, and then opened out. And Maddie, who had considered herself accustomed to marvels after her time under the hill, gave a long sigh of amazement. The cavern was beyond size. Maddie had heard tales of the great cathedrals of World's End, cathedrals as big as cities with spires of glass, and in her imagination they might have been something like this. Even so, the sheer hugeness of the space almost defeated her. It was a bristling vastness of luminous blue ice, its ceiling vaulted in a thousand bewildering swirls and fantails, its height lifted unimaginably by glassy pillars as broad as barn doors. It stretched out forever, or so it first seemed, and the light seemed trapped within the ancient ice, a light that shone like a distillation of stars. For a long time Maddie stared, breathless. The ceiling was open in part to the sky. A fragment of moon stood outlined against a patch of darkness. From the gaps in the vaulting, icicles fell, tumbling and plunging hundreds of feet to hang crystalline above her head. "If I threw a stone," thought Maddie with a sudden chill, "or if I were even to raise my voice." But the icicles were the least of a thousand wonders that filled the cavernous hall. There were strands of filigree no thicker than a spider's web. There were flowers of glass with leaves of frozen gauze. There were sapphires and emeralds growing out of the walls. There were acres of floor, smoother than marble, fit for a million dancing princesses. And the light, It shone out from everywhere, clean and cold and pitiless. As her eyes adjusted, Maddie saw that it was made from signatures of magic, thousands of them, it seemed, crisscrossing the rapturous air. Maddie had never, never in her life seen so many signatures. Their brightness left her speechless. God's alive, she thought. One eye is bright and Loki's is brighter, but this makes them look like candles in the sun. She'd been moving, wide-eyed, bewildered, further into the cavern. Every step showed her new marvels. She could hardly breathe, hardly think for wonderment. Then, in front of her, she saw something that momentarily eclipsed everything else. A raw-edged block of blue ice with thin columns at its four corners. Maddie peered closer and gave a cry as she saw, embedded deep beneath the ice, something that could only be a face. Well, that is somebody who has been asleep for a very long time, and whether she deserves to be awakened, or in fact whether it's a good idea to awaken her, is very much up to you to find out. Now, thank you for all of you for coming. It's lovely being here, as always, and have a nice day, all of you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Madeline Albright, Stephen Cannell, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on January 12th, 2008.